willing it into existence. For even those attributes can be broken. True will is quiet humility, resilience, and flexibility. The other kind of will is weakness, disguised by bluster and ambition. See which lasts longer under the hardest of obstacles. The discipline of the will. Because he has become more myth than man, most people are unaware that Abraham Lincoln battled crippling depression his entire life. Known at the time as melancholy, his depression was often debilitating and profound, nearly driving him to suicide on two separate occasions. His penchant for jokes and bawdy humor, which we find more pleasant to remember him for, was, in many ways, the opposite of what life must have seemed like to him during his darker moments. Though he could be light and joyous, Lincoln suffered periods of intense brooding, isolation, and pain. Inside, he struggled to manage a heavy burden that often felt impossible to lift. Lincoln's life was defined by enduring and transcending great difficulty. Growing up in rural poverty, losing his mother while he was still a child, educating himself, teaching himself the law, losing the woman he loved as a young man, practicing law in a small country town, experiencing multiple defeats at the ballot box as he made his way through politics, and of course the bouts of depression, which at the time were not understood or appreciated as a medical condition. All of these were impediments that Lincoln reduced with a kind of prodding, gracious ambition, and smiling, tender endurance. Lincoln's personal challenges had been so intense that he came to believe that they were destined for him in some way, and that the depression, especially, was a unique experience that prepared him for greater things. He learned to endure all this, articulate it, find benefit and meaning from it. Understanding this is the key to understanding the man's greatness. For most of Lincoln's political career, slavery was a dark cloud that hung over our entire nation, a cloud that could and had to lift. Some ran from it, others resigned themselves to it, or became apologists. Most assumed it meant the permanent breakup of the Union, or worse, the end of the world as they knew it. It came to be that every quality produced by Lincoln's personal journey was exactly what was required to lead the nation through its own journey and trial. Unlike other politicians, he was not tempted to lose himself in petty conflict and distractions. He could not be sanguine. He could not find it in his heart to hate like others would. His own experience with suffering drove his compassion to allay it in others. He was patient because he knew that difficult things took time. Above all, he found purpose and relief in a cause bigger than himself and his personal struggles. The nation called for a leader of magnanimity and force of purpose. It found one in Lincoln, a political novice who was nevertheless a seasoned expert on matters of will and patience. These attributes were born of his own severe experience, as he often called it, and the characteristics were representative of a singular ability to lead the nation through one of its most difficult and painful trials, the Civil War. As crafty and ambitious and smart as he was, Lincoln's real strength was his will. The way that he was able to resign himself to an onerous task without giving into hopelessness, the way he could contain both humor and deadly seriousness, the way he could use his own private turmoil to teach and help others, the way he was able to rise above the din and see politics philosophically. "This too shall pass," was Lincoln's favorite saying, one he'd once said was applicable in any and every situation. To live with his depression, Lincoln had developed a strong inner fortress that girded him, and in 1861 it again gave him what he needed in order to endure and struggle through a war that was about to begin. Over 4 years, the war was to become nearly incomprehensibly violent, and Lincoln, who'd found it hard at first to avoid, would fight to win justly and finally to end it with malice towards none. Admiral David Porter, who was with Lincoln in his last days, described it as though Lincoln seemed to think only that he had an unpleasant duty to perform, and set himself to perform it as smoothly as possible. We should count ourselves lucky to never experience such a trial, or be required, as Lincoln had been, to hold and be able to draw from our own personal woe in order to surmount it. And we certainly can and must learn from his poise and courage. Clear-headedness and action are not always enough, in politics or in life. Some obstacles are beyond a snap of the fingers or a novel solution. It is not always possible for one man to rid the world of a great evil or stop a country bent towards conflict. Of course, we try, because it can happen, but we should be ready for it not to, and we need to be able to find a greater purpose in this suffering and handle it with firmness and forbearance. This was Lincoln, always ready with a new idea or an innovative approach, whether it was sending a supply boat instead of reinforcements to the troops besieged at Fort Sumter, or timing the Emancipation Proclamation with a Union victory at Antietam to give it the appearance of strength, but equally prepared for the worst, and then prepared to make the best of the worst. Leadership requires determination and energy, and certain situations, at times, call on leaders to marshal that determined energy simply to endure, to provide strength in terrible times. Because of what Lincoln had gone through, because of what he'd struggled with and learned to cope with in his own life, he was able to lead, to hold a nation, a cause, an effort together. This is the avenue for the final discipline, the will. If perception and action were the disciplines of the mind and the body, then the will is the discipline of the heart and the soul. The will is the one thing we control, completely, always. Whereas I can try to mitigate harmful perceptions and give 100% of my energy to actions, those attempts can be thwarted or inhibited. My will is different, because it is within me. Will is fortitude and wisdom, not just about specific obstacles, but about life itself, and where the obstacles we are facing fit within it. It gives us ultimate strength, as in the strength to endure, contextualize, and derive meaning from the obstacles we cannot simply overcome, which, as it happens, is a way of flipping the unflippable. Even in his own time, Lincoln's contemporaries marveled at the calmness, the gravity, and the compassion of the man. Today, those qualities seem almost godly, almost superhuman. His sense of what needed to be done set him apart, as though he was above or beyond the bitter divisions that weighed everyone else down, as though he was from another planet. In a way, he was, or at least he had traveled from somewhere very far away, somewhere deep inside himself, from where others hadn't. Schooled in suffering, to quote Virgil, Lincoln learned to comfort those who suffer too. This too is part of the will, to think of others, to make the best of a terrible situation that we tried to prevent but could not, to deal with fate with cheerfulness and compassion. Lincoln's words went to people's hearts because they came from his, because he had an access to part of the human experience that many had walled themselves off from. His personal pain was an advantage. Lincoln was strong and decisive as a leader, but he also embodied the Stoic maxim, sustine et abstine, bear and forbear. Acknowledge the pain, but trod onward in your task. Had the war gone on even longer, Lincoln would have led his people through it. Had the Union cause lost the Civil War, he'd have known that he'd done everything he could in pursuit of victory. More important, had Lincoln been defeated, he was prepared to bear whatever the resulting consequences with dignity and strength and courage. Providing an example for others in victory or in defeat, whatever occurred. With all our modern technologies come the conceited delusion that we control the world around us. We are convinced that we can now, finally, control the uncontrollable. Of course, that is not true. It is highly unlikely we will ever get rid of all the unpleasant and unpredictable parts of life. One needs only to look at history to see how random and vicious and awful the world can be. The incomprehensible happens all the time. Certain things in life will cut you open like a knife. When that happens, at that exposing moment, the world gets a glimpse of what's truly inside you. So what will be revealed when you're sliced open by tension and pressure? Iron? Or air, or bullshit. As such, the will is the critical third discipline. We can think and act and finally adjust to a world that is inherently unpredictable. The will is what prepares us for this, protects us against it, and allows us to thrive and be happy in spite of it. It is also the most difficult of all the disciplines. It's what allows us to stand undisturbed while others wilt and give in to disorder. Confident, calm, ready to work regardless of the conditions. Willing and able to continue, even during the unthinkable, even when our worst nightmares have come true. It's much easier to control our perceptions and emotions than it is to give up our desire to control other people and events. It's easier to persist in our efforts and our actions than to endure the uncomfortable or the painful. It's easier to think and act than it is to practice wisdom. These lessons come harder, but are, in the end, the most critical to wrestling advantage from adversity. In every situation, we can always prepare ourselves for more difficult times. Always accept what we are unable to change. Always manage our expectations. Always persevere. Always learn to love our fate and what happens to us. Always protect our inner self, retreat into ourselves. Always submit to a greater, larger cause. Always remind ourselves of our own mortality. And of course, prepare to start the cycle once more. Build your inner citadel. If thy faint in the day of adversity, thy strength is small. Proverbs 24:10. By age 12, Theodore Roosevelt had spent almost every day of his short life struggling with horrible asthma. Despite his privileged birth, his life hung in a precarious balance. The attacks were an almost nightly near-death experience. Tall, gangly, and frail, the slightest exertion would upset the entire balance and leave him bedridden for weeks. One day, his father came into his room and delivered a message that would change the young boy's life. "Theodore, you have the mind, but haven't got the body. I'm giving you the tools to make your body. It's going to be hard drudgery, and I think you have the determination to go through with it." You'd think that this would be lost on a child, especially a fragile one born into great wealth and status. But according to Roosevelt's youngest sister, who witnessed the conversation, it wasn't. His response, using what would become his trademark cheerful grit, was to look at his father and say with determination, "I'll make my body." At the gym that his father built on the second floor porch, young Roosevelt proceeded to work out feverishly every day for the next 5 years, slowly building muscle and strengthening his upper body against his weak lungs and for the future. By his early 20s, the battle against asthma was essentially over. He'd worked, almost literally, that weakness out of his body. That gym work prepared a physically weak but smart young boy for the uniquely challenging course on which the nation and the world were about to embark. It was the beginning of his preparation for and the fulfillment of what he would call the strenuous life. And for Roosevelt, life threw a lot at him. He lost his wife and his mother in rapid succession. He faced powerful, entrenched political enemies who despised his progressive agenda, was dealt defeat at the ballot box, the nation was embroiled in foreign wars, and he survived nearly fatal assassination attempts. But he was equipped for all of it, because of his early training, and because he kept at it every single day. Are you similarly prepared? Could you actually handle yourself if things suddenly got worse? We take weakness for granted. We assume that the way we're born is the way we simply are, that our disadvantages are permanent, and then we atrophy from there. That's not necessarily the best recipe for the difficulties of life. Not everyone accepts their bad start. They remake their bodies and their lives with activities and exercise. They prepare themselves for the hard road. Do they hope they will never have to walk it? Sure. But they are prepared for it in any case. Are you? Nobody is born with a steel backbone. We have to forge it ourselves. We craft our spiritual strength through physical exercise and our physical hardiness through mental practice. Mens sana in corpore san, a sound mind in a strong body. This approach goes back to the ancient philosophers. Every bit of the philosophy they developed was intended to reshape, prepare, and fortify themselves for the challenges to come. Many saw themselves as mental athletes. After all, the brain is a muscle like any other active tissue. It can be built up and toned through the right exercises. Over time, their muscle memory grew to the point where they could intuitively respond to every situation, especially obstacles. It is said of the Jews, deprived of a stable homeland for so long, their temples destroyed and their communities in the diaspora, they were forced to rebuild not physically but within their minds. The temple became a metaphysical one, located independently in the mind of every believer. Each one, wherever they'd been dispersed around the world, whatever persecution or hardship they faced, could draw upon it for strength and security. Consider the line from the Haggadah. In every generation, a person is obligated to view himself as if he were the one who went out of Egypt. During Passover Seder, the menu is bitter herbs and unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. Why? In some ways, this taps into the fortitude that sustained the community for generations. The ritual not only celebrates and honors Jewish traditions, but it prompts those partaking in the feast to visualize and possess the strength that has kept them going. This is strikingly similar to what the Stoics called the inner citadel, that fortress inside of us that no external adversity can ever break down. An important caveat is that we are not born with such a structure, it must be built and actively reinforced. During the good times, we can strengthen ourselves and our bodies, so that during the difficult times, we can depend on it. We protect our inner fortress so that it may protect us. To Roosevelt, life was like an arena, and he was a gladiator. In order to survive, he needed to be strong, resilient, fearless, and ready for anything. And he was willing to risk great personal harm and expend massive amounts of energy to develop that hardiness. You'll have far better luck toughening yourself up than you ever will trying to take the teeth out of a world that is, at best, indifferent to your existence. Whether we are born weak like Roosevelt or are currently experiencing good times, we should always prepare for things to get tough. In our own way, in our own fight, we are all in the same position Roosevelt was in. No one is born a gladiator. No one is born with an inner citadel. If we're going to succeed at achieving our goals, despite the obstacles that may come, this strength and will must be built. To be great at something takes practice. Obstacles and adversity are no different. Though it would be easier to sit back and enjoy a cushy modern life, the upside of preparation is that we're not disposed to lose all of it. Least of all, our heads, when something or someone suddenly messes with our plans. It's almost a cliche at this point, but the observation that the way to strengthen an arch is to put weight on it, because it binds the stones together and only with tension does it hold weight, is a great metaphor. The path of least resistance is a terrible teacher, though. We can't afford to shy away from the things that intimidate us. We don't need to take our weakness for granted. Are you okay being alone? Are you strong enough to go a few more rounds if it comes to that? Are you comfortable with challenges? Does uncertainty bother you? How does pressure feel? Because these are things that will happen to you. No one knows when or how, but their appearance is certain. And life will demand an answer. You chose this for yourself, a life of doing things. Now you better be prepared for what it entails. It's your armor plating. Doesn't make you invincible, but it helps prepare you for when fortune shifts. And it always does. Anticipation. Thinking negatively. Offer a guarantee, and disaster threatens. An ancient inscription at the Oracle of Delphi. A CEO calls her staff into the conference room on the eve of the launch of a major new initiative. They file in and take their seats around the table. She calls the meeting to attention and begins. I have bad news. The project has failed spectacularly. What went wrong? What? But we haven't even launched yet. That's the point. The CEO is forcing an exercise in hindsight, in advance. She is using a technique designed by psychologist Gary Klein, known as the pre-mortem. In a post-mortem, doctors convene to examine the causes of a patient's unexpected death so they can learn and improve for the next time a similar circumstance arises. Outside of the medical world, we call this a number of things: a debriefing, an exit interview, a wrap-up meeting, a review. Whatever it's called, the idea is the same. We're examining the project in hindsight, after it happened. A pre-mortem is different. In it, we look to envision what could go wrong, what will go wrong, in advance, before we start. Far too many ambitious undertakings fail for preventable reasons. Far too many people don't have a backup plan because they refuse to consider that something might not go exactly as they wished. Your plan and the way things turn out rarely resemble each other. What you think you deserve is also rarely what you'll get. Yet we constantly deny this fact and are repeatedly shocked by the events of the world as they unfold. It's ridiculous. Stop setting yourself up for a fall. No one has ever said this better than Mike Tyson, who, reflecting on the collapse of his fortune and fame, told a reporter, "If you are not humble, life will visit humbleness upon you." If only more people had been thinking worst-case scenario at critical points in our lifetimes. The tech bubble, Enron, 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, the real estate bubble, these might have been avoidable. No one wanted to consider what could happen, and the result? Catastrophe. Today, the pre-mortem is increasingly popular in business circles, from startups to Fortune 500 companies and the Harvard Business Review. But like all great ideas, it is actually nothing new. The credit goes to the Stoics. They had an even better name: pre-meditatio malorum, which means premeditation of evils. A writer like Seneca might be reviewing or rehearsing his plans, say, to take a trip, and then he would go over, in his head or in writing, the things that could go wrong or prevent it from happening. A storm could arise, the captain could fall ill, the ship could be attacked by pirates. He said, "Nothing happens to the wise man against his expectation, nor do all things turn out for him as he wished, but as he reckoned. And above all, he reckoned that something could block his plans." We are always prepared for our disruption, always working that disruption into our plans, fitted, as they say, for defeat or victory. And let's be honest, a pleasant surprise is a lot better than an unpleasant one. What if? Then I will. What if? Instead, I'll just. What if? No problem, we can always. And in the case where nothing could be done, the Stoics would use it as an important practice to do something the rest of us too often fail to do: manage expectations. Because sometimes the only answer to what if is, it will suck, but we'll be okay. Your world is ruled by external factors. Promises aren't kept. You don't always get what is rightfully yours, even if you earned it. Not everything is clean and straightforward as the games they play in business school. Be prepared for this. You have to make concessions for the world around you. We are dependent on other people. Not everyone can be counted on like you can. Though, let's be honest, we are all our own worst enemy sometimes. And that means people are going to make mistakes and screw up your plans. Not always, but a lot of the time. If this comes as a constant surprise, each and every time it occurs, you're not only going to be miserable, you're going to have a much harder time accepting it and moving on to attempts number 2, 3, and 4. The only guarantee ever is that things will go wrong. The only thing we can use to mitigate this is anticipation, because the only variable we control completely is ourselves. Common wisdom provides us with the maxims: beware the calm before the storm. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. The worst is yet to come. It gets worse before it gets better. The world might call you a pessimist. Who cares? It's far better to seem like a downer than to be blindsided or caught off guard. It's better to meditate on what could happen, to probe for weakness in our plans, so those inevitable failures can be correctly perceived, appropriately addressed, or simply endured. Then, the real reason we won't have any problems thinking about bad luck is because we're not afraid of what it portends. We're prepared in advance for adversity. It's other people who are not. In other words, this bad luck is actually a chance for us to make up some time, were like the runners who train on hills were at an altitude so they can beat the runners who expected the course would be flat. Anticipation doesn't magically make things easier, of course. But we are prepared for them to be as hard as they need to be, or as hard as they actually are. As a result of our anticipation, we understand the range of potential outcomes and know that they are not all good. They rarely are. We can accommodate ourselves to any of them. We understand that it could possibly all go wrong. And now we can get back to the task at hand. You know you want to accomplish X, so you invest time, money, and relationships into achieving it. About the worst thing that can happen is not something going wrong, but something going wrong and catching you by surprise. Why? Because unexpected failure is discouraging, and being beaten back hurts. But the person who has rehearsed in their mind what could go wrong will not be caught by surprise. The person ready to be disappointed won't be. They will have the strength to bear it. They are not as likely to get discouraged or to shirk from the task that lies before them or make a mistake in the face of it. You know what's better than building things up in your imagination? Building things up in real life. Of course, it's a lot more fun to build things up in your imagination than it is to tear them down. But what purpose does that serve? It only sets you up for disappointment. Chimeras are like bandages. They only hurt when torn away. With anticipation, we have time to raise defenses, or even avoid them entirely. We are ready to be driven off course because we've plotted a way back. We can resist going to pieces if things don't go as planned. With anticipation, we can endure. We are prepared for failure and ready for success. The Art of Acquiescence. The fates guide the person who accepts them and hinder the person who resists them. Cleanthes. Thomas Jefferson, born quiet, contemplative, and reserved, purportedly with a speech impediment. Compared to the great orators of his time, Patrick Henry, John Wesley, Edmund Burke, he was a terrible public speaker. His heart set on politics, he had two options: fight against this sentence or accept it. He chose the latter, channeling the energy into his writing, which others put into oratory instead. There he found his medium. He found he could express himself clearly. Writing was his strength. Jefferson was the one the founding fathers turned to when they needed the Declaration of Independence. He wrote one of the most important documents in history in a single draft. Jefferson just wasn't a public speaker. That doesn't make him less of a man for acknowledging it and acting accordingly. Same goes for Edison, who most people have no idea was almost completely deaf, or Helen Keller, who was both deaf and blind. For both, it was the deprivation of these senses, and the acceptance rather than the resentment of that fact, that allowed them to develop different but acutely powerful senses to adjust to their reality. It doesn't always feel that way, but constraints in life are a good thing, especially if we can accept them and let them direct us. They can push us to places and to develop skills that we'd otherwise never have pursued. Would we rather have everything? Sure, but that isn't up to us. True genius, as the famous Dr. Samuel Johnson once said, is a mind of large general powers accidentally determined in some particular direction. That channeling requires consent. It requires acceptance. We must allow some accidents to happen to us. I can't just give up. I want to fight. You know you're not the only one who has to accept things you don't necessarily like, right? It's part of the human condition. If someone we knew took traffic signals personally, we would judge them insane. Yet this is exactly what life is doing to us. It tells us to come to a stop here, or that some intersection is blocked, or that a particular road has been rerouted through an inconvenient detour. We can't argue or yell this problem away. We simply accept it. That is not to say we allow it to prevent us from reaching our ultimate destination, but it does change the way we travel to get there and the duration of the trip. When the doctor gives you orders or a diagnosis, even if it's the opposite of what you wanted, what do you do? You accept it. You don't have to like or enjoy the treatment, but you know that denying it only delays the cure. After you've distinguished between the things that are up to you and the things that aren't, and the break comes down to something you don't control, you've got only one option: acceptance. The shot didn't go in, the stock went to zero, the weather disrupted the shipment. Say it with me. C'est la vie. It's all fine. You don't have to like something to master it or to use it to some advantage. When the cause of our problem lies outside of us, we are better for accepting it and moving on, for ceasing to kick and fight against it and coming to terms with it. The Stoics have a beautiful name for this attitude. They call it the art of acquiescence. Let's be clear that this is not the same as giving up. This has nothing to do with action. This is for the things that are immune to action. It is far easier to talk of the way things should be. It takes toughness, humility, and will to accept them for what they actually are. It takes a real man or woman to face necessity. All external events can be equally beneficial to us because we can turn them all upside down and make use of them. They can teach us a lesson we were reluctant to otherwise learn. For instance, in 2006, a longtime hip injury finally caught up with Lakers coach Phil Jackson, and the surgery he had to fix it severely limited his courtside movement. Relegated to a special captain-style chair, he couldn't pace the sidelines or interact with the players in the same way. Initially, Jackson was worried that this would impact his coaching. In fact, sitting back on the sideline above the rest of the bench increased his authority. He learned how to assert himself without ever being overbearing the way he had been in the past. But to get those unexpected benefits, we have to accept the unexpected costs, even though we'd rather not have them in the first place. Unfortunately, we are often too greedy to do this. We instinctively think about how much better we'd like any given situation to be. We start thinking about what we'd rather have. Rarely do we consider how much worse things could have been. And things can always be worse. Not to be glib, but the next time you lose money, remember that you could have lost a friend. Lost that job? What if you'd lost a limb? Lost your house? You could have lost everything. Yet we squirm and complain about what was taken from us. We still can't appreciate what we have. The hubris at the core of this notion that we can change everything is somewhat new. In a world where we can beam documents around the world in nanoseconds, chat in high-definition video with anyone, anywhere, predict the weather down to the minute, it's very easy to internalize the assumption that nature has been domesticated and submits to our whim. Of course it hasn't. People didn't always think this way. The ancients, and the not-so-ancients, used the word fate far more frequently than us because they were better acquainted with it, and exposed to how capricious and random the world could be. Events were considered to be the will of the gods. The fates were forces that shaped our lives and destinies, often not with much consent. Letters used to be signed Deo Volente, God willing. Who knew what would happen? Think of George Washington putting everything he had into the American Revolution and then saying, "The event is in the hand of God." Or Eisenhower, writing to his wife on the eve of the Allied invasion of Sicily. Everything we could think of has been done. The troops are fit and everybody is doing his best. The answer is in the lap of the gods. These were not guys prone to settling or leaving details up to other people, but they understood ultimately that what happened would happen, and they would go from there. It's time to be humble and flexible enough to acknowledge the same in our own lives. That there is always someone or something that could change the plan, and that that person is not us. As the saying goes, man proposes, but God disposes. Or, as fate would have it, heaven forbid, nature permitting, Murphy's Law. Whatever version you prefer, it's all the same. Not that much has changed between their time and ours. They were just more cognizant of it. Look. If we want to use the metaphor that life is a game, it means playing the dice or the chips or the cards where they fall. Play it where it lies, a golfer would say. The way life is gives you plenty to work with. plenty to leave your imprint on. Taking people and events as they are is quite enough material already. Follow where the events take you, like water rolling down a hill. It always gets to the bottom eventually, doesn't it? Because A, you're robust and resilient enough to handle whatever occurs. B, you can't do anything about it anyway. And C, you're looking at a big enough picture and long enough timeline that whatever you have to accept is still only a negligible blip on the way to your goal. We're indifferent, and that's not a weakness. As Francis Bacon once said, nature, in order to be commanded, must be obeyed. Love everything that happens. Amor fati. My formula for greatness in a human being is amor fati. That one wants nothing to be different, not forward, not backward, not in all eternity. Not merely bear what is necessary, still less conceal it, but love it. Nietzsche. At age 67, Thomas Edison returned home early one evening from another day at the laboratory. Shortly after dinner, a man came rushing into his house with urgent news. A fire had broken out at Edison's research and production campus a few miles away. Fire engines from the 8 nearby towns rushed to the scene, but they could not contain the blaze. Fueled by the strange chemicals in the various buildings, green and yellow flames shot up 6 and 7 stories, threatening to destroy the entire empire Edison had spent his life building. Edison calmly but quickly made his way to the fire, through the now hundreds of onlookers and devastated employees, looking for his son. "Go get your mother and all her friends," he told his son with childlike excitement. "They'll never see a fire like this again." "What?" "Don't worry," Edison calmed him. "It's all right. We've just got rid of a lot of rubbish." That's a pretty amazing reaction. But when you think about it, there really was no other response. What should Edison have done? Wept? Gotten angry? Quit and gone home? What exactly would that have accomplished? You know the answer now. It's nothing. So he didn't waste time indulging himself. To do great things, we need to be able to endure tragedy and setbacks. We've got to love what we do and all that it entails, good and bad. We have to learn to find joy in every single thing that happens. Because there was a little more than rubbish in Edison's buildings, years and years of priceless records, prototypes, and research were turned to ash. The buildings, which had been made of what was supposedly fireproof concrete, had been insured for only a fraction of their worth. Thinking that they were immune to such disasters, Edison and his investors were covered for about a third of the damage. Still, Edison wasn't heartbroken. Not as he could have and probably should have been. Instead, it all invigorated him. As he told a reporter the next day, he wasn't too old to make a fresh start. "I've been through a lot of things like this," he said. "It prevents a man from being afflicted with ennui." Within about 3 weeks, the factory was partially back up and running. Within a month, its men were working 2 shifts a day, churning out new products that the world had never seen. Despite a loss of almost $1 million, more than $23 million in today's dollars, Edison would marshal enough energy to make nearly $10 million in revenue that year, $200-plus million today. He not only suffered a spectacular disaster, but he recovered and replied to it spectacularly. The next step after we discard our expectations and accept what happens to us, after understanding that certain things, particularly bad things, are outside our control, is this: loving whatever happens to us and facing it with unfailing cheerfulness. It is the act of turning what we must do into what we get to do. We put our energies and emotions and exertions where they will have real impact. This is that place. We will tell ourselves, "This is what I've got to do or put up with. Well, I might as well be happy about it." Here's an image to consider. The great boxer Jack Johnson in his famous 15-round brawl with Jim Jeffries. Jeffries, the great white hope, called out of retirement like some deranged Cincinnatus to defeat the ascendant black champion. And Johnson, genuinely hated by his opponent in the crowd, still enjoying every minute of it, smiling, joking, playing the whole fight. Why not? There's no value in any other reaction. Should he hate them for hating him? Bitterness was their burden, and Johnson refused to pick it up. Not that he simply took the abuse. Instead, Johnson designed his fight plan around it. At every nasty remark from Jeffrey's corner, he'd give his opponent another lacing. At every low trick or rush from Jeffrey's, Johnson would quip and beat it back, but never lose his cool. And when one well-placed blow opened a cut on Johnson's lip, he kept smiling. A gory, bloody, but nevertheless cheerful smile. Every round he got happier, friendlier, as his opponent grew enraged, tired, eventually losing the will to fight. In your worst moments, picture Johnson, always calm, always in control, genuinely loving the opportunity to prove himself, to perform for people, whether they wanted him to succeed or not. Each remark bringing the response it deserved and no more, letting the opponent dig his own grave. Until the fight ended with Jeffries on the floor and every doubt about Johnson silenced. As Jack London, the famous novelist, reported from the ringside seats, "No one understands him, this man who smiles. Well, the story of the fight is the story of a smile. If ever a man won by nothing more fatiguing than a smile, Johnson won today." That man is us, or rather it can be us, if we strive to become like him. For we're in our own fight with our own obstacles, and we can wear them down with our relentless smile, frustrating the people or impediments attempting to frustrate us. We can be Edison, our factory on fire, not bemoaning our fate, but enjoying the spectacular scene, and then starting the recovery effort the very next day, roaring back soon enough. Your obstacle may not be so serious or violent, but they are nevertheless significant and outside your control. They warrant only one response, a smile. As the Stoics commanded themselves, cheerfulness in all situations, especially the bad ones. Who knows where Edison and Johnson learned this epigram, but they clearly did. Learning not to kick and scream about matters we can't control is one thing. Indifference and acceptance are certainly better than disappointment or rage. Very few understand or practice that art, but it is only a first step. Better than all of that is love for all that happens to us, for every situation. The goal is not, I'm okay with this, not, I think I feel good about this, but I feel great about it, because if it happened, then it was meant to happen, and I am glad that it did when it did. I am meant to make the best of it, and proceed to do exactly that. We don't get to choose what happens to us, but we can always choose how we feel about it. And why on earth would you choose to feel anything but good? We can choose to render a good account of ourselves. If the event must occur, amor fati, a love of fate, is the response. Don't waste a second looking back at your expectations. Face forward and face it with a smug little grin. It's important to look at Johnson and Edison because they weren't passive. They didn't simply roll over and tolerate adversity. They accepted what happened to them. They liked it. It's a little unnatural, I know, to feel gratitude for things we never wanted to happen in the first place. But we know at this point the opportunities and benefits that lay within adversities. We know that in overcoming them, we emerge stronger, sharper, empowered. There's little reason to delay these feelings, to begrudgingly acknowledge later that it was for the best, when we could have felt that in advance, because it was inevitable. You love it because it's all fuel. And you don't just want fuel, you need it. You can't go anywhere without it. No one or no thing can. So you're grateful for it. That is not to say that the good will always outweigh the bad, or that it comes free and without cost. But there is always some good, even if only barely perceptible at first, contained within the bad. And we can find it and be cheerful because of it. Perseverance. Gentlemen, I am hardening on this enterprise. I repeat, I am now hardening towards this enterprise. Winston Churchill. Odysseus leaves Troy after 10 long years of war destined for Ithaca, for home. If only he knew what was ahead of him, 10 more years of travel. That he'd come so close to the shores of his homeland, his queen, and his young son, only to be blown back again. That he'd face storms, temptation, a cyclops, deadly whirlpools, and a six-headed monster. Or that he'd be held captive for 7 years and suffer the wrath of Poseidon. And of course, that back in Ithaca his rivals were circling, trying to take his kingdom and his wife. How did he get through it? How did the hero make it home despite it all? Creativity, of course, and craftiness and leadership and discipline and courage. But above all, perseverance. We talked about Ulysses S. Grant across the river from Vicksburg, searching for some way, any way, to get across and take it. That's persistence. So was Odysseus, standing at the gates of Troy, trying everything before the success of the Trojan horse. Persistence. Everything directed at one problem, until it breaks. But a 10-year voyage of trials and tribulations, of disappointments and mistakes without giving in, of checking your bearings each day and trying to inch a little closer to home, where you'll face a whole host of other problems once you arrive? Iron-hearted and ready to endure whatever punishment the gods decide you must? And to do it with courage and tenacity in order to make it back to Ithaca? That's more than persistence. That is perseverance. If persistence is attempting to solve some difficult problem with dogged determination and hammering until a break occurs, then plenty of people can be said to be persistent. But perseverance is something larger. It's the long game. It's what happens not just in round one, but in round two and every round after, and then the fight after that and the fight after that until the end. The Germans had a word for it. Sitzfleisch. Staying power. Winning by sticking your ass to the seat and not leaving until after it's over. Life is not about one obstacle, but many. What's required of us is not some short-sighted focus on a single facet of a problem, but simply a determination that we will get to where we need to go, somehow, some way, and nothing will stop us. We will overcome every obstacle, and there will be many in life, until we get there. Persistence is an action, perseverance is a matter of will. One is energy, the other, endurance. And of course, they work in conjunction with each other. That Tennyson line again in full. Made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Persist and persevere. Throughout human history, there have been many strategies for overcoming the seemingly endless problems that affect us as individuals and as a group. Sometimes the solution was technology, sometimes it was violence, sometimes it was a radical new way of thinking that changed everything. We have looked a lot at those examples. But across the board, one strategy has been more effective than all the others, and it is responsible for far more than anything else. It works in good situations and in bad situations, dangerous situations and seemingly hopeless situations. When Antonio Pigafetta, the assistant to Magellan on his trip around the world, reflected on his boss's greatest and most admirable skill, what do you think he said? It had nothing to do with sailing. The secret to his success, Pigafetta said, was Magellan's ability to endure hunger better than the other men. There are far more failures in the world due to collapse of will than there ever will be from objectively conclusive external events. Perseverance, force of purpose, indomitable will. These are the traits that were once uniquely part of the American DNA, but they've been weakening for some time. As Emerson wrote in 1841, if our young men miscarry in their first enterprises, they lose all heart. If the young merchant fails, men say he is ruined. If the finest genius studies at one of our colleges and is not installed in an office within 1 year afterwards in the cities or suburbs of Boston or New York, it seems to his friends and to himself that he is right in being disheartened and in complaining the rest of his life. Think of what he'd say about us now. What would he say about you? the majority of my generation decides to move back in with their parents after college. Unemployment for them is twice the national average. According to one 2011 study by the University of Michigan, many graduates aren't even bothering to learn how to drive. The road is blocked, they are saying, so why get a license I won't be able to use? We whine and complain and mope when things won't go our way. We are crushed when what we were promised is revoked, as if that's not allowed to happen. Instead of doing much about it, we sit at home and play video games or travel, or worse, pay for more school with more loan debt that will never be forgiven. And then we wonder why it isn't getting any better. We'd be so much better following the lead of Emerson's counterexample. Someone who is willing not to try one thing, as he put it, but tries all the professions, who teams it, farms it, peddles, keeps a school, preaches, edits a newspaper, goes to Congress, buys a township, and so forth in successive years, and always, like a cat, falls on his feet. This is perseverance. And with it, Emerson said, with the exercise of self-trust, new powers shall appear. The good thing about true perseverance is that it can't be stopped by anything besides death. To quote Beethoven, the barriers are not erected which can say to aspiring talents and industry, thus far and no farther. We can go around or under or backward. We can decide that momentum and defeat are not mutually exclusive. We can keep going, advancing, even if we've been stopped in one particular direction. Our actions can be constrained, but our will can't be. Our plans, even our bodies, can be broken. But belief in ourselves, no matter how many times we are thrown back, we alone retain the power to decide to go once more, or to try another route, or at the very least to accept this reality and decide upon a new aim. Determination, if you think about it, is invincible. Nothing other than death can keep us from following Churchill's old acronym, KBO, keep buggering on. Despair? That's on you. No one else is to blame when you throw in the towel. We don't control the barriers or the people who put them there, but we control ourselves, and that is sufficient. The true threat to our determination, then, is not what happens to us, but us ourselves. Why would you be your own worst enemy? Hold on, and hold steady. Something bigger than yourself. A man's job is to make the world a better place to live in, so far as he is able, always remembering that the results will be infinitesimal, and to attend to his own soul. Leroy Percy. A United States Navy fighter pilot named James Stockdale was shot down in North Vietnam in 1965. As he drifted back to Earth after ejecting from his plane, he spent those moments contemplating what awaited him down below. Imprisonment? Certainly. Torture? Likely. Death? Possibly. Who knew how long it would take, or if he'd ever see his family or home again? But the second Stockdale hit the ground, that contemplation stopped. He wouldn't dare think of himself. See, he had a mission. During the Korean War a decade earlier, individual self-preservation showed its ugly side. In the terrible freezing prison camps of that war, it had very much become every American soldier for himself. Scared to death, the survival instincts of American prisoners of war kicked in so overwhelmingly that they ended up fighting and even killing each other simply to stay alive, rather than fighting against their captors to survive or escape. Stockdale, then a commander, aware that he would be the highest-ranking Navy POW the North Vietnamese had ever captured, knew he couldn't do anything about his fate. But as a commanding officer, he could provide leadership and support and direction to his fellow prisoners, who included the future Senator John McCain. He could change that situation and not let history repeat itself. This would be his cause. He would help his men and lead them. Which is exactly what he proceeded to do for more than 7 years, two of which were spent wearing leg irons in solitary confinement. Stockdale didn't take his obligation as a commander lightly. He went so far as to attempt suicide at one point, not to end his sufferings, but to send a message to the guards. Other soldiers in the war effort had given their lives. He would not disgrace them or their sacrifice by allowing himself to be used as a tool against their common cause. He would rather hurt himself than contribute, even against his will, to hurting or undermining others. He proved himself formidable to whatever physical harm his captors threatened him with. But he was human, and he understood that his men were too. The first thing he did was throw out any idealistic notions about what happens to a soldier when asked to give up information under hours of torture. So he set up a network of support inside the camp, specifically to help soldiers who felt ashamed for having broken under the pressure. "We're in this together," he told them. He gave them a watchword to remind them. U.S. Unity over self. John McCain, in his own cell nearby, responded in essentially the same way, and was able to endure indescribable torture for the same reasons. Hoping to stay in the McCain family's prestigious military legacy in the United States, the Viet Cong repeatedly offered McCain the opportunity to be released and return home. He wouldn't take it. He would not undermine the cause, despite self-interest. He stayed, and was tortured, by choice. These two men were not zealots for the cause. They certainly had their own doubts about the war in Vietnam. But their cause was their men. They cared about their fellow prisoners and drew great strength by putting their well-being ahead of their own. Hopefully you will not find yourself in a POW camp anytime soon. But we are in our own tough economic times. In fact, they can sometimes feel downright desperate. You're young. You didn't cause any of this. It isn't your fault. We all got screwed. This only makes it easier to lose our sense of self, to say nothing of our sense of others, to think, if only privately, I don't care about them, I've got to get mine before it's too late. Especially when the leaders in your supposed community make it clear that that is exactly how they feel about you when it comes down to the crunch. But no, ignore that. It is in this moment that we must show the true strength of will within us. A few years ago, in the middle of the financial crisis, the artist and musician Henry Rollins managed to express this deeply human obligation better than millennia of religious doctrine ever have. He said, "People are getting a little desperate. People might not show their best elements to you. You must never lower yourself to being a person you don't like. There is no better time than now to have a moral and civic backbone, to have a moral and civic true north. This is a tremendous opportunity for you, a young person, to be heroic." Not that you need to martyr yourself. See, when we focus on others, on helping them or simply providing a good example, our own personal fears and troubles will diminish. With fear or heartache no longer our primary concern, we don't have time for it. Shared purpose gives us strength. The desire to quit or compromise on principle suddenly feels rather selfish when we consider the people who would have been affected by that decision. When it comes to obstacles and whatever reactions they provoke, boredom, hatred, frustration, or confusion, just because you feel that way doesn't mean everyone else does. Sometimes when we are personally stuck with some intractable or impossible problem, one of the best ways to create opportunities or new avenues for movement is to think, if I can't solve this for myself, how can I at least make this better for other people? Take it for granted for a second that there is nothing else in it for us, nothing we can do for ourselves. How can we use this situation to benefit others? How can we salvage some good out of it? If not for me, then for my family, or for the others I am leading or those who might later find themselves in a similar situation. What doesn't help anyone is making this all about you all the time. Why did this happen to me? What am I going to do about this? You'll be shocked by how much of the hopelessness lifts when we reach that conclusion, because now we have something to do. Like Stockdale, now we have a mission. In the light of blinding futility, we've got marching orders and things that must be done. Stop making it harder on yourself by thinking about I. Stop putting that dangerous I in front of events. I did this. I was so smart. I had that. I deserve better than this. No wonder you take losses personally. No wonder you feel so alone. You've inflated your own role and importance.